This is episode number 742 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to talk about Terrificon, as well as Avengers Infinity War. Our comics this week will be Suicide Squad number 1, Rebirth the Hellblazer, Civil War 2 Amazing Spider-Man number 2, and Archie number 10. And our creator spotlight this week is Veronica Fish, the artist on Archie, Silk, and Pirates of Mars, who is about to start a run on Spider-Woman.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
Seconds to comply.
God, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome, everybody, to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letenry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well, except I realized I forgot to mention something.
Oh, mention it.
My new tattoo.
Are you sure you didn't mention your new tattoo?
No, didn't mention it last episode, didn't mention it.
You definitely mentioned that you were going to get it.
Yes.
But now you have it.
I got it.
And I've seen it, and I've also seen your daughter's.
Yep, you saw it the day after.
I did, when it still had the, what were you putting on it, like some sort of balm?
Yeah, I got to put an A&D ointment on it.
Oh, there you go.
Yep, so you got to put the A&D ointment on it to keep it all, you know, because it's got to start peeling.
Right.
Because basically they rip your skin apart.
Right.
Putting the sucker in.
Yeah, no, it's a very... very gentle.
Yes. The good thing is if you're scared to get one, after 4 or 5 minutes, your whole arm goes numb anyway. Who cares? There's only one spot where I kind of jumped a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So it's the Pittsburgh Penguin logo. And when they were doing the eye, it was one guy, Rich Lyons.
Okay.
Sacred Body in Enfield, Connecticut. Fantastic job. My good buddy Luis Ramos recommended him, and he couldn't have picked anybody better. When he did the eye, for some reason, it really hurt. So when my daughter was getting hers, I'm like, oh my God, it's going to hurt, it's going to hurt. And then I just started grabbing onto the table. So something about making the eye was painful.
Okay.
But other than that, hour and 10 minutes and loving it.
So if I ever decide to get a tattoo, no eyes.
Yeah. And if you're going to get the swinging fryer, just have them have sunglasses on or something.
Yeah. All right. Well, good to know. Good to know. We wanted to mention that Terrificon is coming up the 19th through the 21st of August. That will be the next show that we will be at. We will be doing panels at that show. We will be doing many interviews at that show. Dan Slott's going to be at that show. John Wesley Shipp's going to be at that show. Katrina Law is going to be at that show. Our good buddy Jason May, I believe, will be at that show. Everybody's going to be at that show. Is Caramagna coming for that show as well?
I believe he's going to be there for one day.
I think he will be
Saturday.
There. So, I mean, it's going to be a fantastic show. We cannot wait for that. It's at Mohegan Sun. You can go to Terrificon.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. But that show is turning into something spectacular.
Yes.
And I cannot wait to go to it. And that will be the next one that we're at. And coming off of the great Plastic City Comic Con, I'm back in show mode now.
Yeah.
You know,
and
I'm ready.
These are two good ones, too, because Mitch Halleck, who's the promoter, does a fantastic job. He is a fan himself. So when he's putting a show together, he's thinking from the fans' point of view, the fans' perspective. What do they want? What can I give them? And he's giving them a huge show. And we always bring this up because to us, this is one of the most important parts, considering we do a lot of traveling in Boston and New York. Free parking.
Yes.
You can't say anything bad about that.
You can't overstate free parking, Matthew.
No, not when it's $35-$40 a pop when you're parking. And you're parking in a covered garage. And you're walking to the show. As you're walking to the show, you're walking on carpeted, air-conditioned comfort.
There you go.
Great stuff. We are going to be set up when you first walk into the show. There's going to be a big TARDIS. The spider... Oh, can I say anything about that yet? Did he mention it?
I believe he did mention it because I saw it on Dan Slott's Twitter that there will be an actual Spider-Mobile at the show.
The spider dune buggy is going to be there. So I think we are going to be with all of those things.
Yep.
So very excited about that.
That's cool. That seems a fitting place to be putting us out at that show. So
yes.
So for feedback, we got some responses to episode number 739, which we had talked about Spider-Woman, and we'll be talking about Spider-Woman again in our Creator Spotlight this week. Michael Wessel said Spider-Woman is by far the best Marvel book, and John Souter said, I haven't liked the Spider-Woman comic in the past, but this new series looks promising. He also said, rest in peace to Jack Davis, one of the best. I did not read EC Comics until I was in my teens, but remember his ads from various comics of the 70s and 80s.
Completely forgot about that. Holy cow, I need to do something for the website. So I will be putting something up. I mentioned at work, because on our board, I always put somebody, if some celebrity passed away. That is a huge loss because I completely forgot he was the look, image, and feel of what EC Comics was.
Uh-huh.
And then changed styles a ton and then became the face of Mad Magazine.
So we'll look for that on the website in the coming week. Matthew will have a tribute up on secretidentitypodcast.com. In news, the Avengers Infinity War, which was supposed to be the two-part Marvel movie, the next big Avengers thing, is now one movie.
Hmm.
Avengers Infinity War will no longer be a two-part film, according to Variety. Disney will release Avengers Infinity War on May 4th, 2018, as originally announced. But that's it. But the second Avengers film directed by the Russo brothers is now just an untitled Avengers film.
Huh.
So apparently we're going to get the Infinity piece, and then they might do a different story for the next one, as opposed to tying up two Avengers movies with that storyline.
Yeah.
I'm kind of okay with that.
I am too.
Because I think when you are talking about a 2018, 2019, a lot happens in a year, you know, and the Marvel Universe keeps changing and... You know, I think they have to be thoughtful about keeping the story moving.
Yes.
And bogging down two movies with one storyline. I don't know.
And you also have so many other opportunities to, if there's any unfinished business in it, you could make the next Hulk movie the part two. You know, you could do a lot of stuff
with
that.
Well, and again, they called it Untitled Avengers movie. It could still be a direct sequel to whatever the Infinity War storyline is, but it gives them a little more room to say, oh, let's see how this goes.
Yeah.
What if the response is not great?
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to do Batman versus Superman 2.
Yeah, after we already planned on it and already made it.
Although I think it's interesting because we weren't going to talk about Suicide Squad. We haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I am excited to see it. I will be going to see it probably this weekend as we record this show. The critical reviews have not been great so far. They've been very mixed.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm hearing from a lot of people is that it's a really fun movie, which is all that I care about.
Yep.
Most of the movies that I like are considered to be bad movies by critics, so that doesn't faze me in the least. What I hope is that the tone of this movie is going to sort of set the tone for the rest of the DC Universe movies, and if the Justice League trailer from Comic-Con was any indication, I think that's happening.
Yes.
And so I'm ready to be completely done with my unhappiness over Batman versus Superman and love Suicide Squad and love everything else moving forward.
Yeah. Zack Snyder, here's your check. Thank you. You're angry and you're mean, and we want to have a happier DC universe.
But they're not giving him the check in the door.
No.
They're just allowing Geoff Johns to have more influence, which is a great thing.
Yep.
And putting a little more faith, hopefully, in the directors of the movies that they're going to be putting out. So hopefully we're going to see that turnaround. And I think it starts with Suicide Squad. So I'm going to be really excited to come back and talk about Suicide Squad in the next week or so after we see it.
Now, you failed to mention a name. Stranger Dan Evans is now in charge working in this Marvel, in this DC movie.
He is. And if you would have told me that we were going to name drop him, I would have remembered what his title was because it's like second in command over there. But he works directly with Geoff Johns and he has purview over all of the TV shows and all that kind of stuff, games, everything else. So, yes, he is firmly entrenched in the DC property universe. So anything that involves DC properties, anything that involves those characters, Dan has a part of, whether it's a game, a movie, a book, a novelization, whatever, he has purview over that. And I will tell you, anybody who knows Dan knows that he is one of the people that you would want to be in that position because he has a love for those characters, much like Geoff Johns.
Yep.
Like when you hear Geoff Johns, you're like, okay, well, he loves those characters. So that's great. It's the same with Dan. He loves those characters, so you're in good hands.
King Dan.
So there you go.
All hail King.
All right, well, that's just a little bit of news. Now let's jump right into comic books this week. And because we've been talking about Suicide Squad, I picked up the Suicide Squad Rebirth, number one. I don't know if it's officially number one or whatever it is, because I get confused over the one shots and then the actual ones.
So you know how I figured out? It'll say Rebirth on the top underneath, like the it'll say Rebirth the character. Oh, that's
then
the
it's
regular.
Just Suicide Squad number one.
It's let me see which one you got. That is Suicide Squad. That's Rebirth. Suicide Squad Rebirth.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, thank you for clarifying that.
It took me a couple wrong bought books to figure
that out. It's got an Amanda Connor cover, which is right there worth $3.
Yes.
And I bought this book, much like I bought Harley Quinn, and we talked about that in the last episode. I wanted to see, I'm always interested to see, how does this book play to someone who is seeing the movie trailers? Mm-hmm. How does this book play to someone who hasn't been reading Suicide Squad, doesn't even know what Suicide Squad is? I haven't been reading Suicide Squad. I didn't read any of it during the New 52. So I'm coming into this completely cold. And you'll help me out, Matthew, as we go through, because Rick Flagg makes an appearance in this book.
Yes.
And I don't really have a good frame of reference for Rick Flagg. Mm-hmm. So anyways, we start off and you are seeing photographs of members of the Suicide Squad that are showing them at their most brutal. You've got a picture of Harley in a prison uniform being dragged off a guard that she's biting half of the face off. And then you just see Killer Croc and you see Deadshot and you see Katana and you see all of this stuff. And someone is saying the Suicide Squad is finished. You turn the page, it's the president. The president has called Amanda Waller into his office and is saying, you know, I don't even know how this organization came together, but it's not happening anymore. Task Force X, you know, a squad of costumed felons has been wreaking havoc around the world. This is terrible for the United States. And it stops here. And so you have Waller, who is just kind of looking at the president and waiting for him to finish, you know, his rant. And then she says, you know, with respect, Mr. President, because he says, I swore an oath to defend this country. We do not do this, not here. And she said, with respect, Mr. President, that's a lie. And he's like, what? And she says, look, ideals belong on flagpoles and in museums and in movie theaters. This is reality, and reality is ugly. So she does her usual Waller and basically says, this is a thing that has to exist because this group does jobs that other people can't do. The Justice League can't go out and do what these guys are doing. Our soldiers are not going to go out and do what these guys are doing. And he says, well, you have to be accountable in some way, shape, or form. The fact that you guys are not accountable to anyone or don't have any, there needs to be somebody on the team who is representing the morals of this country and upholding that kind of stuff. And she says, well, I have just the person. And that's when she flips open the file of Rick Flagg Jr. Mm-hmm. And she says, this is Colonel Rick Flagg, Navy SEAL. Flagg was awarded the Medal of Honor for the U.S. military's highest decoration for his actions in Afghanistan, Purple Heart, Silver Medal. He's unimpeachable. He's a guy who values loyalty and values ideals. He'll be a good fit for the team. His grandfather was part of the original Task Force X in World War II.
Yeah.
And so the president kind of reluctantly agrees to give the authorization to take him out of prison. She says, Flagg was on a special assignment, but I can arrange for him to be detailed exclusively for this mission. Well, it turns out that he was in a prison. But the president reluctantly signs off on it. And the next thing you know, Waller is meeting with this guy at Camp Delta in Guantanamo Bay. And she's explaining to him, look, I know that you kind of took the rap for a mission that went bad and you're sort of sitting here, but I'm giving you an opportunity. You can come join this team because I think they really need you. And I think you could bring something to the team. And he says, you know, why would I want to work with a team of lowlifes and villains and all this kind of stuff? You know, and she says, you know, well, you know, it's the Suicide Squad. And he says, oh, yeah, you know, Task Force X, you got Harley Quinn, you got Boomerang, you got Deadshot, you know, all these psychos. He says, you're crazy. I will not lower myself to be one of your bad guys. And she says, oh, there's worse bad guys out there. What I need is a good guy to lead this team, though. And she says, so there's a mission going on right now. There's a bomb that threatens us. And she says, so you can either stay in your cell or you can join the team. And now we cut to the present. And so you see that he's joined the team. And what you see is that you have Harley, Captain Boomerang, and Deadshot have been flown to an island in, I believe, Mongolia. Is that where they went to? Inner Mongolia. That's where they've been flown to. There is a small island city where a bomb has just been set off that gave everybody superpowers. because there's a scientist and an engineer that's been captured, and what he was working on was this metabomb. And what it does is for 36 hours, when it blows up, it will give everybody that is non-powered superpowers, and it will drain the superpowers of everybody who has them. And so Waller's basically saying, like, what if this got out? What if this got – what if somebody did this in an American city or something like that? So the Suicide Squad gets sent in, and the next thing you know, they're battling a whole bunch of superpowered people, and it's just the three of them. And they're trying to rescue this scientist and get him out of there because he has another bomb in a briefcase, and he also knows how to create them. And so they're going to take this guy out of there. So you've got nonstop action. You've got Harley with a huge machine gun. And the scientist is saying, look, you know, I never wanted this. I just wanted to help humanity. And Harley's like, oh, well, we have a lot in common. I went into psychiatry. I went into public service. I like to help people too. And she's shooting people left and right and taking out people. Well, as they're trying to get this guy out of here, he ends up getting captured and he's holding on to this briefcase and he's like, they'll build a superpowered army. You know, this is the gene bomb. You can't let them take it. And no sooner does he says you can't let them take it than a boomerang comes flying by and chops off both of his hands and he drops the briefcase because Digger doesn't care about the scientist guy. He says, no, don't worry, mate. We didn't let the briefcase get away. And, you know, the briefcase is sitting there with two hands attached to it. Meanwhile, this guy's getting dragged to his inevitable death. And Harley's like, there's no way we're going to be able to save that guy. So Deadshot shoots him in the head and puts him down. So they end up losing the scientist but gaining the briefcase. And they still have to fight off all of these superpowered beings that are now surrounding them. And that's when they're told to fire off the bomb, because the bomb is going to take away all the superpowers from these people. So they do that. They set off the bomb. Everybody loses their powers. However, now they have an island full of soldiers that want to kill them. And so they have to face all of them. And that's when Rick Flagg shows up and he jumps into the middle of the fray and he says, okay, let's save the world. And that's the way the first issue ends. So pretty action-packed first issue. It's written by Rob Williams. Philip Tan does the pencils. Jonathan Glapion, Scott Hanna, Sandu Florea does the inks on that one. Alex Sinclair does the colors. And who is the editor? Brian Cunningham and Andy Corey are the editors on that one. So a action-packed first issue, you get a quick overview of who the players are. You get to meet Rick Flagg, and you get to see that he is going to be the new leader of the Suicide Squad in this particular series. Now, Killer Croc is on the cover of this book, but doesn't appear in this issue at all. It's just Harley and Captain Boomerang and Deadshot that were on this particular mission. So I'm sure we're going to see him in the next issue, but plenty of action. The story moves quickly. It gets you right into the mix. They're already out on their first mission. So if you're looking for a good jump on point for this book, I think that the Rebirth version of it is a great place to jump on. If you've seen the movie and you're wanting to know more about Suicide Squad, or you want to kind of get involved with it, I think that you're going to be fine picking up this book.
Very good. Yeah, the Rebirth, everything just seems to be just flying on all cylinders.
I really haven't read a Rebirth book yet that I walked away like, I didn't like that.
It's funny because the ones that I'm not that as enamored with are still better than most of the stuff I've been reading
right
over the last couple of years. My problem is I just need to really be smarter than I am, and I got to start trimming because I'm into everything and I can't be into everything.
Right.
So a book I should have stayed away from because now I'm into this one is The Hellblazer Rebirth. I never read Hellblazer. My whole anything about Hellblazer is the show when Constantine was on, and the movie that wasn't as bad as I think people tend to think with Keanu Reeves. So I picked up this book for a couple reasons, obviously, because I kind of want to see what's going on. And I don't know if you knew who's doing the art on this one, Brian, but the writer is Simon Oliver. Artist? Some guy named Moritat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was a huge one for me.
By the way, if you have not read the All-Star Western from the New 52 with Moritat on art, holy crap.
Yeah, that's why I
saw
that. Fantastic. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh. So you open up and I'll just show you the first page. That is so
you know
Moritat-ish.
What to expect. I mean, absolutely.
He does a great job with this one. So we start out in London where you see John Constantine is fighting. This is some years ago. He's fighting some demon. And the demon is basically telling him, you know, you need to get out of England because... if you stay here, it is going to be a horrible mess. I am going to cause all these problems, so you need to get out of here. And Constantine is just mouthing off at him, and he's telling him all this stuff about, you know what, why don't you just throw that plague out there and just destroy everything, see what you got. And he says, well, damn you, Constantine. So he's talking, and he says, and that, boys and girls, is how my last weekend in New York City came to be. I had to leave England to come to the Big Apple. I was banished here. And you see him getting an apartment. You see him hanging out with people. He's getting an apartment. He's showing this place, and it's a disaster. And you see that he's talking to a stewardess. And the stewardess is like, so where are you headed? And he goes, oh, I'm heading home. So he is now back in England. And he is getting off the plane. He's running into a guy named Chaz, who's his buddy. And he's, you know, saying, you know, it's great to be back. And, you know, are you sure it's good to be back? Because are there going to be any issues that are going on? And you see that the second he is there, all of a sudden, all sorts of things start to happen. You see that as he is leaving, there's sort of like this essence that is coming out of the cab. There's something that's going on. And you know, Constantine's asking how this guy's wife is. And he's like, you know what, can I stay with you? And he's like, look, you can't stay with me because you know how my wife feels. And he's driving. And every time you see somebody sneeze, you see like a splatter of blood all over something. And that's sort of the plague that Constantine is kind of doing it. And I think the whole story and base of this was if he came back to England, he was going to be causing this plague.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Why he was in the United States. So as he is going through, you see in Chilham Village, Kent, this woman is there talking to somebody, and all of a sudden she is getting a sense because she's meditating, and all of a sudden she's like, oh, bloody hell, what do you want from me now, John Constantine? So it's funny because England is a very drab, dark country. I mean, it's very rainy. It's very overcast.
Apologies to any of our English listeners.
My wife said that the month she spent in Wales, like 4 days, it didn't rain.
She spent a month in Wales?
Yeah, in the summer as a kid.
Wow.
Yeah. So she, you know, most people will talk about the fact that it's very dry. It's very gray. It's overcast. However, in this sort of world that you're seeing, it isn't overcast. It's like apocalyptic orange.
That's a little bit different than a typical rainy day, yeah.
Yes. So you're seeing that there is something going on. So Constantine is now in a park, and he is drawing all over the wall. And all of a sudden, you know, you see this voice off camera. You dare show your face again, Constantine? And he turns around. He's like, laughing boy. And you see that it is the demon that he left. And this demon, it's so cool because he's wearing very colonial suits. He's got the frilly the frock, the long jacket with the buttons, the pantaloon kind of thing, which I wish those fashions would come back because I would be all over that.
Oh, you
that.
Would rock those, yeah.
Oh, I love it. So he's explaining that, you know, hey, you came back, you brought this knife to kill a demon, and now all you've done is really just kind of sign the death warrant for every single person in England. And all of a sudden, you know, Constantine cuts himself with the sword that he was kind of swinging in the air. Blood hits the markings that he's been putting on the ground. And then you see that it kind of explodes into something. And you find out that he has gotten a little bit stronger and a little bit smarter. So this demon's like, oh, Constantine, do you know what you've just done? And he goes, oh, yeah, laughing boy, I pretty much know what I did. And he explains to him that he's unleashed a curse. But what he has done is he has released sort of the anti-curse, and you're seeing that people are starting to get sick, and they're on buses, they're walking on the streets, everybody's like coughing and sneezing, and the alien's like, yeah, you've just become Typhoid Mary, you have now destroyed England. And he's explaining, well, you know what, I really kind of didn't. And from what I can understand of Constantine is that when he battles these demons, half the fun is that he's kind of mouthing off to them, challenging him in all these ways.
He's like the master of loopholes.
Yes.
And so he's always finding a way to work around whatever language that was in the contract or whatever the parameters of this particular agreement were or something like that. And so usually by the end of the story, he has figured out a loophole, but it also almost always ends up with him screwing somebody over.
Yeah.
And which is why no one is ever happy to see him.
And that's why he's in the position he's in the first
right.
place.
Nobody's ever happy to see John Constantine.
Nope. So as this young woman that we saw earlier is walking through the streets, you see these kids coming out and they're sneezing and coughing. And She's like, oh, damn you, Constantine. So she gets on her motorcycle. Birds are dropping dead everywhere. Now at the Tower of London, so she's heading to the Tower of London. You turn the page and you see Shazam, Wonder Woman, and Swamp Thing are all together talking.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, so Swamp Thing obviously has the best relationship with Constantine of the three.
If you could call it that, yes.
So Shazam's like, we are going to go in there and we are going to punch him in the brain and we are going to end this guy right now. He's got no place among us. So Swamp Thing is in there going, look, you got to understand what he's doing is going to be helpful. It's not necessarily the right way. There might be collateral damage, but I think that we need to just let him do what he's doing. And I'm kind of asking you a favor, especially you, Shazam, just let him do what needs to be done. And, Shazam looks at Swamp Thing and goes, I trust you counted your fingers after you shook his hand for whatever
right,
deal
that's
you
what
made.
I'm talking about because he's.
And Wonder Woman's like, enough, Shazam. And she goes, do you trust Constantine? He goes, I don't necessarily say I can trust him, but I think he's got the right intentions in this. So let's just let this play out, see what's going on. So all of a sudden this demon is like, you know what? You've just unleashed devastation on your city. This is really cool. Now Constantine is drinking and eating while he's there, kind of taunting this demon a little bit more. And all of a sudden this woman shows up and the demon is like, wait a minute, what did you just do? And he's like, well, you know I don't have a lot of friends, but this woman is here. She's kind of here to help me out. And you'll see that she'll kind of fix things. And her name is Mercury. So Mercury comes in and so the demon basically doesn't have a name. And if you name him, he has to go back to hell. So she looks over and she goes, oh yeah, that's Nibus. And he's like, how did you know my name? And she goes, well, and he's like, well, see, you got to play the game. I was kind of playing chicken with you. I was trying to see and give you the opportunity to spread your anger, see what you could do. And you've basically kind of shown that you're a psychopath. And Mercury here is going to send you back. So all of a sudden, he gets sent back to where he comes. You see, everybody that was hacking and coughing is no longer hacking and coughing. England has become a sunny gray again and not that apocalyptic orange. And as he's talking and saying, you see a briefcase with an empty food container next to it and a booze bottle. And he's like, you know what? I'm quite frankly here to save the day, and I don't care what happens. I don't give a blank. That's how it ends.
Wow.
So unfortunately, that issue ends with me sitting there going, you know what? I think I'm going to be reading Hellblazer.
All right, well, we're going to jump over to the Marvel Universe and talk about a Civil War-related book. Now, we're not talking about the regular series because, as we've mentioned before, it's just not very good. And so, at least in my opinion, I'm not a fan of Civil War II. However, I am a fan of Spider-Man, Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to talk about Civil War II Amazing Spider-Man number 2 because it involves an interesting story of a former villain perhaps going back to his old ways. So written by Christos Gage, art by Travel Foreman, colors by Rain Barreto, letters by our good buddy Joe Caramagna, and edited by Nick Lowe. Ulysses is the name of the Inhuman who can see visions of things that could happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what the heroes are all fighting about in Civil War II, is whether or not that they should be trusting those visions and using him to stop things before they happen. We're not even going to get into that, though, because what has happened is Spider-Man, in an effort to try and get to understand Ulysses a little bit better and kind of learn about his powers, has been having him hang around with him a little bit. And so as we start off this issue, we are in Long Island where Spidey is battling a Quintronic Man, which is kind of like a Voltron robot thing. And he ends up defeating this thing by getting the power core to overheat and all the guys have to evacuate. And he saves them. And as they're going away from the scene, after he gets all the guys arrested, he's saying to Ulysses, you know, that was a big win. You know, you just saved a lot of people by letting me know that that was going to happen. And so he's kind of on the fence about whether or not this could be a good thing, you know? So they get back to Parker Industries, and one of the things that Ulysses had seen is that one of Peter's employees, a guy by the name of Clayton Cole, who used to be a minor league villain called Clash, he was going to turn bad again. He's going to be fighting Spider-Man. And that was the vision that he saw, is of this guy fighting Spider-Man. So Peter's been thinking, you know, what is the catalyst that's going to make this guy turn back to going to what he used to do? And he's been racking his brain about it. And the rest of the issue is really kind of a look at this story from Clayton's perspective. So you start 8 o'clock in the morning. He's walking down the street in his, you know, business clothes, and he steps in a puddle and ruins his new shoes. Then he runs into a guy who is named Sully, and they used to be henchmen together for the Owl. And this guy, Sully, is saying, oh, man, I got a great new job. I'd like to cut you in on. I want you to get a part of, be a part of it. And Clayton's explaining to him, look, I have a legitimate job now. I can't do that stuff anymore. I could be violated on my parole just for talking to you. And the guy's like, oh, no problem. You know, it's good to see you're doing well for yourself. Next thing you know, you see Clayton visiting with his parents in the morning, and his parents are basically just berating him, but in a very passive aggressive way, about the fact that he hasn't made more of himself. The fact that he's working for Peter Parker, the fact that he's should be smarter than Peter Parker, but he's still working for the guy. And the only reason that Clayton went there, because his parents have always been like this, is because he wanted to get his grandmother's wedding ring, which she left to him, because he wants to propose to this woman that he works with. And when he's talking to his parents about it, they're like, oh, well, you know, she already has a kid, and you know, we don't think this is a good idea. And he's like, I didn't ask your permission. I just came here to get the ring. So you see that he's really excited. He's not paying attention to what they're saying, because he's going to propose to this woman, Donna, I believe is her name. And they've been spending a lot of time together. And so he goes to work. And the next thing you see at 10 o'clock in the morning is he's sitting at the table with Donna, and Donna is breaking up with him. And she's saying, you know, I really like you, and my son seems to be getting really attached to you, and I didn't realize he was so looking for a father figure that he has sort of, he's moving faster with this than we are. And I don't know that I am comfortable with that, because when he finds out about your history and he finds out that you used to be basically a bad guy, I don't know how he's going to deal with that. And so I think we need to break it off. Meanwhile, he's sitting there with the wedding ring in his hand, about to unveil it and propose to her. So this woman breaks up with him, and he's sitting there in the break room dejected. And he's got a coworker that comes in that says, hey, you know, I'm sorry about what happened with Donna. That really sucks. But, you know, you just got to get back into the game, man. And he flips out on the dude and is like, you don't know anything about me. You don't know anything about this. This is ruining my life. You know, you're a kid just out of school, and you're making five figures. My life is over. And he sort of has a meltdown, but then he pulls it back together. And that's when Peter shows up with Ulysses, and Peter is dressed as Spider-Man. And so in the first issue, this is when the conversation happened, where Ulysses told Spidey, you got to watch out for that guy. So Clayton sees that after Spidey and Ulysses are talking, that they're kind of looking at him differently. And he starts to get paranoid. Why are they looking at me like that? Do they think something's up with me? Do they, you know, what's going on? And so he kind of eavesdrops on them and hears that there's being questions raised about his, whether or not he's still a good guy. And so he's kind of upset about that. And he ends up talking to Spider-Man, and he flips out on Spider-Man. And Spider-Man's explaining, look, this guy has visions and he has these powers. And he says, look, I don't give a crap. You know, I helped you against the Zodiac. I have helped you. I followed all your rules, and now you don't believe me. And he kind of storms out of there. And you see that he goes to a henchman's bar and starts hanging around with guys that he used to pal around with. And he's having second thoughts about whether or not going straight was kind of the right idea. And Peter has really stepped in it with him now. And now he's not showing up at work. And you see as the issue winds down that he is putting back his, he talked to the tinkerer, and he got a new costume. And now he's put that costume on, and he reaches out to the robot master, Strom is his name, and says, that job that you had, let's arrange a meet. And so you see that it's kind of pushed him over the edge. And that's the way the issue ends. And I really like that they're going back and doing more with this guy, because there was a series of issues that was like Spider-Man 1.2, 3, 4, 5, where they went back and showed you the origin of this guy back when Peter was young.
Yep.
And so they've kind of built him and retroactively put him in the Spideyverse as this character who is a reformed villain that Peter has given a second chance. And now you're seeing his storyline play out about how, even though he's been given a second chance, this thing that he did kind of haunts him forever. And it's an interesting look at this character. And so I like when the stories sort of add to the mythology of these additional characters that don't get a lot of time in the spotlight in a main Spidey issue. Like, mm-hmm. you see him pop up once in a while. He helped out with the Zodiac stuff, but he's not a character that gets a piece of story every issue or yeah. even every arc. And so it's cool to see them kind of go down this road. And again, I'm enjoying the tie-in issues to Civil War. And I did break down and buy whatever the next issue of Civil War was, but it's definitely, unless people want me to talk about it on the show, I'm not really interested in talking about it because it's just a storyline that to me feels pretty hollow.
Yeah.
But that's a tale for another day, Matthew.
Speaking of hollow, you know what was on cable a couple nights ago? The Hollow Man.
Oh, with Kevin Bacon?
Yes.
Yeah.
Crazy good.
Great B-horror movie.
Crazy. And you look at the cast and it was, you've got, I can't remember, the guy who played Jonah Hex was in it, Josh Brolin.
Uh-huh.
He was in it. Elizabeth Shue.
Yep.
You got the Greenberg guy from Lost. Crazy cast.
I'm not that familiar with Lost. I fell
and
off
And he was in
Lost.
Heroes. And the guy who was at the Kineticon last year, the one that my wife flipped out about.
Oh, Greg Grunberg?
Greg Grunberg, Alan Greenberg.
Greenberg.
I don't even know who Alan Greenberg is.
Dude, you are something special when it comes to names.
There you go. So one name that I will tell you, Archie.
Yes.
Number 10. This is the latest issue, just came out. Three covers. Brian has the Veronica Fish cover, and I have the Sandy Jarrell almost throwback cover.
Oh, yeah.
Of A Little Beach Party.
Yep.
So, signed by Veronica Fish, who we will be hearing from in a little bit.
Shortly.
As soon as I'm done yapping.
As soon as you're done yapping.
All right, so we'll make this really quick. Mark Waid is the writer. The aforementioned Veronica Fish is the artist. Colors by Andre Seismanowicz, Jack Morelli, the letterer, John Goldwater, the publisher, Mike Pellerito, editor, and king of all Archie things.
El Presidente.
Going on there. El Presidente. Viva la El Presidente. We need to talk to Mike about the trade deadline because interesting things went on with the Yankees.
Yes.
So we'll have to talk to him about that. But I digress. We're talking about Archie. And this is an election issue, kind of coinciding with the elections that are going on in the real world. In Riverdale, this is for mayor, and you have Hiram Lodge, Veronica's dad, who is running for mayor against the teacher, and his name is Mr. Collier. Now, this is sort of a thing that when I read this, I really kind of remember a lot of how when we were younger, we would hear different stories about certain teachers, because this is one where it's Archie explaining to us, the reader, I want to talk to you about a teacher named Mr. Collier. And he's explaining about Mr. Collier. He's an institution for 30 years. He's heard stories about how when a poor kid can't afford lunch, all of a sudden, Mr. Collier accidentally misplaces his, and you see him whipping a lunch to Moose. And then you see, but then again, I also heard he threw a junior in a wood chipper. So we had all those teachers growing up.
Right. There were definitely teachers when you were in high school that there was a story attached to.
Yeah. And you would hear the things, and he was in like a home ec class or something. And you turn the page and you see him flipping out on Archie because you see a dishwasher that is now open and popcorn is just coming out of it. So Archie must have thought, hey, I want to make a whole lot of popcorn. It's making me think I want to try this.
Or it could be that Archie put it in the microwave and it blew up the dishwasher. Because as we've seen with Archie, like anything mechanical, he will break.
There was one thing in here because they used to mention all the time how he even burned water.
Yeah, he's like, yeah. you can't let him do anything.
Yeah, so he's like, how? And he goes, don't even answer me that. The phrase, my name is Archie Andrews, is answer enough. You're a walking cyclone. And you see all the kids in the class going, yep, that's pretty accurate. But Veronica is very upset. So she takes out her phone and starts filming this. He's like, you're a menace when you're distracted, which is all the time. I'm trying to figure out how you blew up the chemistry lab while you were in English class. So, you know, the kids are all like, wow, he is really getting them. And they're saying, well, he just, you work for your grades. That's his job. And you see that, so everybody's getting a different opinion of him. And then Archie's explaining, well, you know what? Of course, Kevin's going to say that. He gets an A. And, you know, Jughead gets a C. Betty got a B minus. And he, you know, was explaining how, you know, he never pandered to the overachiever Betty. He would help her by probably giving her a B minus when she should have got an A to teach her how to deal with these things. So all of a sudden, you know, this is in here on the phone. Veronica gets in there, starts mouthing off. All of a sudden, you know, later on in the day, they're going to Lodge campaign headquarters. Veronica's in there showing a couple of the other girls that the teacher was flipping out. And the campaign manager goes, oh, my gosh, I can't believe you have that. And she goes, you know what? let me see that video, let me borrow it. Unfortunately, that now becomes the campaign, the slander campaign. Do you want this man in charge of your town?
Right.
Look how he treats the kids. Betty starts freaking out. Betty is all insane about this. Mr. Lodge is sort of like, whoa, I didn't realize that this happened, which is why they're supposed to put this is endorsed by the campaign person.
Right.
And then you see Betty is just leaving her lawn, leaving her yard where it has Elect Greg Collier signs all in front of it. She's out there playing baseball with her boyfriend, pissed off, whipping the ball, smashing him. He's like, you gotta relax. She's throwing it. She's gonna hit little kids. She's gonna throw it through the window. And every time it's like she's saying something and her anger is making the ball get thrown harder. So he's like, you know, what is going on? You know, what is this happening? Who's your anger at Mr. Lodge? And she goes, not Lodge, Archie. Then you see the next day, all these people are talking about, you know, oh, I remember, you know, he was such a good student to me, and now I'm a better parent because of him. Then you see the kid, I will not name my future son Moose, writing it on the thing. So you're seeing that these are the parents of these kids. You know, and then another guy's like, those who hated him think that Mr. Lodge is a hero. So you're seeing that this has just divided the town, much like our election cycle going on right now. You are just getting a feel that this is really starting to split everybody, including the kids. So this has now started a rift between Archie and Betty that was already beginning to
right. There were other things that were causing that rift, but this doesn't help.
Yep. So then all of a sudden, Veronica gets really upset because now everybody's treating her crappy because it was her video that is now gone viral that has now caused this problem. So she goes to the campaign headquarters and says, fix this. I pick my friends. They didn't pick me, and now my friends don't want anything to do with me. And the woman's like, oh, don't be silly. Here, come to the rally campaign, and puts a Vote Lodge pin on her. So now she is sitting there trying to figure out how we can fix this. They make a movie because the students obviously want Collier to be the mayor. And then they go to see him, and Archie goes, hey, we did this movie for you. We want you to see it. And as he's getting in the car, you see he's moving. He's out of the campaign, and he's moving. And they're like, oh, this isn't good. He's moving out of town. So now Archie's getting the brunt of all of this. All the teachers are mad at him. Everybody in the town's all mad at him. This campaign rally is now turned into what we're seeing, unfortunately, at every campaign rally. We're seeing people fighting. People are angry. It isn't just a war of words anymore. It's passion, and you're seeing that. Reading this issue has kind of really given me sort of an understanding to why people are so passionate about things. We see it online. We see it with anything. Suicide Squad's a great movie, and you're going to get people that are so pissed off that they're ready to lose their hair over how angry it is. But here you see that Archie and Betty are the voices of reason in this one. They're the ones trying to talk this through, despite the fact that how angry Betty is. And he's like, look, you know, you've got to understand that this is not meant to happen. Veronica didn't mean for this. And she's like, you know what? It's all Veronica's fault anyway. Archie goes in, and the last few pages is where, or the last few panels is where it all kind of falls apart, and you see where the anger really is. Because you know what? Look at her. She's got confidence. She knows who she is. This is what Betty's going through in her life right now. And he hit the nail right on the head. You see her putting the lipstick on. You see her trying on a frilly dress. And Archie all of a sudden realized, oh, I shouldn't have said that. And he's like, Betty, he reaches over. She says, don't touch me. And she storms off because that's where Betty is trying to figure out who she is. She doesn't know who she is. So another amazing, amazing issue. You have a little bit of a story by Mark Waid who talks about Frank Doyle, who did a lot of classic stuff. And you get a 4 or 5 page classic story of Betty, Veronica, and Archie. So number 10 issues in, fantastic book. Love this thing.
Well, that is a great segue into our creator spotlight this week, who is artist Veronica Fish, who did that issue and will now be heading over to Marvel to do the next arc of Spider-Woman.
Mm.
So we talk about that in the interview. She was at the Plastic City Comic Con this week, and I'll let the interview speak for itself because we talk a lot about sort of what I love about her style and how she approaches different projects and things like that. But she was a blast to talk to. And it's always awesome to appreciate someone's work, meet them in person, have them be awesome, Have a great conversation. And we just, it was a great day overall at Plastic City. And this interview, I think, sort of encapsulates that.
Yep.
And so it was fantastic to talk to her. I cannot wait to see what she does on Spider-Woman, because that is a book that I am completely in love with. And Javier Rodriguez has done such an amazing job on that book. And we talk about that and her coming into this. But also, she's working on these books where they're establishing the foundation for these characters and these universes. And she is a part of all of that. And I think that as a creator, man, how cool is that to be able to be involved in the formation of the new Archie universe?
Yep.
You're helping shape that. Spider-Woman, who's becoming a character that's becoming more and more popular at, you know, over at Marvel, you're getting to be a part of that. She was a part of Silk when Silk is, again, in her very early issues. She also works on Pirates of Mars, which is another book that you should check out. And all of that stuff you can sort of see more about at her website, which is veronicafish.com, and her Instagram, which is It's Veronica Fish, which she mentions again at the end of the interview. But I'll put links in the show notes so you can stay up to date with the projects that she's working on, because I absolutely love her style, and I am definitely going to be checking out whatever it is that she's working on. So yeah. Veronica Fish is your creator spotlight this week. That is going to do it for this episode of Secret Identity. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, and this is Brian here in Leominster, Massachusetts for the first annual Plastic City Comic Con, and I'm here with Veronica Fish. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm super excited that we have so many families and people coming to the show. It's a first-year show, and our friends are putting it on, and we couldn't be happier for them. So, and I'm happy that you're here.
Oh, thanks. The response is awesome, and it's my pleasure.
Yeah, it's been great so far. So, I immediately, when I saw that you were here at the show, the first thing that jumped to my mind was the fact that, A, the amazing work that you've done on Archie, but also that you worked on one of my favorite newer characters, which is Silk. So I'm going to start with Silk, because I was excited that you jumped on. Cindy Moon, for me, was a character that I thought really added to the Spider-Man mythos, and you came in, and I believe you did issues 4 and 5. What was that like, and how did you get on that book?
It was great. Let's see, how did I get on that book? I don't know how names are passed from editor to editor. I mean, I don't know the conversation, but when they said, "Do you have time?" I was like, absolutely, yeah. I will make time for this. It was a bit of a struggle because I was doing two monthly books at the same time, and that's fine, because when you like the story and you like the character, and I like Robbie, I think Robbie's a great writer,
yep.
So I was happy to make it work. And it was interesting because for me, when I was working on Archie and Silk at the same time, you're dealing with two completely different types of stories. So you have a lot of action panels that are really dynamic, and then sometimes jumping back into Archie, you have a lot of physical comedy and a lot of conversations going on between two people who are basically standing in a room. Mm-hmm. So how do you, you know, go through the storytelling? And I found that really fun, being able to do two very different things.
And the cool thing, too, about the whole Silk thing is that you're helping to establish the mythology of this character that is fairly new to the Marvel Universe. And so, you know, being in that first group of issues, especially when Silk really started to get the spotlight, I would imagine you guys are getting tons of fan feedback and everything, and you're really defining the style of this character, too, because we were only a few issues in.
Yeah, that was really fun. Like, I kind of had to jump back and forth to make sure that I was reading the correct storyline, mm-hmm. because when you have to draw her in flashback, you know, am I getting the short hair correct? Am I getting the long hair correct?
Right.
I'm just making sure that everything stays right, and that's why you have great editors and assistant editors who can catch you and be like, actually, wait, you need to make her younger. This is before the bunker. I love Cindy, and I love her personality, so it was.
Well, and I'm a lifelong Spider family fan, so I love all the characters in the Spider universe, and we'll talk about the next one that you're going to get to sort of play with in a few minutes. But, of course, you just wrapped up a 6-issue run on Archie, which, again, not that those characters were new to that universe,
sure.
but you're helping define a style of that universe. So for kind of 2 books in a row there, you're sort of in on that foundation. I mean, does that ever get into your head at all while you're working on those projects?
A little bit, because you want to make sure that you're not just doing, let's see, you don't want to just take what you perceive a character to be and just put them in clothes from 2016. Like, you
right.
want to make sure that you are really connecting with the progressive readers today, and you're making something that they want to read, and at the same time, you want to read the storyline too. So it kind of, it's like a, it's a great cycle. So yeah, for Archie, the interesting thing, I actually never read Archie comics growing up, mm-hmm. because whenever I would flip through them, I was always under the impression that Veronica was the mean one.
Yep.
So as like a little kid, I couldn't deal with being the mean one who also had dark hair and bangs. Uh-huh. So I had kind of put it out of my mind for a long time. So then when I got the job and I started going back and reading the Archie comics again, I was able to see it with a fresh face. Mm-hmm. And totally relate to these teenagers again. So yep. I was actually much happier that I was able to come at it later and have a bit of a fresher, you know, opportunity than have ideas of who these characters are for many, many years, right. and then not be able to get out of that.
Right, because especially if you're coming in to work on a character that you have had a ton of experience with, you're bringing your own sort of baggage to that exactly. character. So coming in like that. I think also, though, too, with the new Archie, that... those relationships and those personality traits are a little bit more nuanced in the new series, sure. which really puts, I think, Betty and Veronica in a place where they're not that different from one another, even sure. though they come from very different walks of life.
It's very true. One of the things I was really happy about with the new series was the way that, and this is kind of selfish, like Veronica yeah. wasn't super mean.
Yeah.
And underneath her veneer, she's actually really, I mean, she's a very confident person, and that's a total striking contrast with Betty, who every once in a while feels very nervous, and uh-huh. But she also has her own brand of confidence. But at the same time, Veronica really does want people to like her, mm-hmm. and there's a bit of her that's scared to admit that. So I like that about the deepening layer of, yep. of her. So.
Yeah, and I love that about that book, is you really are getting what it feels like a much deeper look into all of those characters and the relationships that they have. I would be remiss, though, in talking of your work on that book if I did not mention the amazing covers, especially, and I see it at your table, but the jukebox cover that you did for, I think it was Archie number 5, is absolutely stunning. And I just want to know, do you get a ton of feedback about that cover? Because I love it.
Oh, that's very kind of you. And that was actually... Not only was that my first cover on the series, but it was an homage cover, so I had a little bit of a harried feeling. I was like, oh no, because I was taking a classic Time magazine photo by Wayward, and I was trying to update it, because when I was thinking about my own experience in high school and really my first years of college, I actually did play the jukebox at like these old time yeah. diners. So I wasn't sure how they were going to feel about something that was very, very dated.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're wearing modern clothes, and I was happy that they ran with it. And yeah, I'm always extremely touched when people like the work. And
I think too, with covers, like there's different ways to tackle a cover. You know, in some ways, in a lot of times in the old days, the cover would really give you a preview of what was happening right. in the book, or, you know, at least insight into the character. Sometimes they're completely unrelated. But what I loved about that cover in particular is that you felt a sense of camaraderie and love with those characters that I felt like, boy, if I was to show somebody why I like the new version of Archie, or why they should care about these characters or revisit them if they haven't read them before, sure. look at this cover and just feel that.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, actually, I have always gravitated towards all the kids getting along personally
mm-hmm. yep.
in like my own idealized mm-hmm. you know, dream of them.
Yep. And that's kind of how I feel about that too, so it was awesome to see that. So the work on Archie was fantastic, and now I mentioned that I'm a huge Spidey fan. People who listen to our show know that because I blab about it all the time. But a book that I have been raving about since it's been out, basically, is the new Spider-Woman book, which, you know, Dennis Hopeless writing, Javier Rodriguez doing the artwork on that. You are coming onto that book now for a stint on that. How did that project come about?
That came about, I just reached out to the editors that I knew, and I said, you know, I have a gap in my schedule, and if you have anything, and I was absolutely floored when they said, well, do you want to come on for Spider-Woman? Mm-hmm. And I've just said yes. Yes, yeah. I do. I'm a huge fan of both Javier and Dennis. So for issue 10, I was working over Javier's layouts because the deadline was so incredibly tight. So I had about 2 weeks, and I was so incredibly fortunate that Javier had begun that issue before having to leap on to another project, because I feel like that's the perfect transition, mm-hmm. and it really helps me to get... even though I read the book and I love the book, when you start to physically draw it and you see the script, there is a big part of you, like my work on Archie, that really wants to make sure that I'm drawing the feeling of this title.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any proclivity to put my own stamp on it just because I feel like it. It's
right.
not my style right now. I'm actually pretty happy being like, all right, what is the direction of this book? And if you feel as an editor that my art can fit that, then I want to learn. Like, I want to make this the best that it can be. So working over Javier's layouts was a perfect transition. Yep. For that, and he's such a dynamic artist. His incredible movement through the pages, and you have like multi-dimensional space, and the way he like layers in sound effects over, you know, like 2 and 3 point perspective. He's someone I admire so much. So I'm so excited to be able to learn from him and hopefully do the best I can on this book.
Well, and I do feel like your style fits right in with that too, because one of the things that I think stands out about his work is the body language and the facial expressions of characters, how he conveys emotion with his characters, which, as I just talked about with, you know, the Archie cover that you did, I feel like that is a strength of your work as well, is that you can really read the characters well, regardless of what's happening in the scene, based on how you draw them. So to me, that's a perfect fit. But I also feel like that is something that you do extremely well, is you come into books where there is sort of a style that's been established for these characters, and you can certainly tell that it's your work, because I feel like you have your own signature style, but you do such a great job of respecting what came before and sort of adding to it without taking anything away from it. I don't know what the artistic terms are for that, but it sounds like that's a conscious effort when you come in.
I think maybe my background as an illustrator, as opposed to like a fine artist, I enjoy having direction, mm-hmm. and I find that I work best when I have some kind of direction. You know, if you just gave me a blank canvas and just said go, I'd probably stare at it for like a long time. But if you said, okay, here's your theme, go. I need kind of the bones. I need the skeleton. So I'm happy that it worked out like that, and no artist can draw like any other artist. You just
right.
can't. And no matter how much you admire a certain person and you study their work for a long time, it'll never come out like them
right.
anyway. So you don't want to try too hard to ever be I don't want to use the word copy. Like, you don't want to imitate them because you are afraid that's what readers want.
Sure.
You have to know that you can do your own thing. But at the same time, I do feel a sense of security being like, okay, great. This is the voice of the book, and I'm going to try my best to match that.
And I feel like that's super important, too, when a book is early in its run, because I think as comic book fans, we've come to expect that in this current age, there's a lot of rotating creative teams, especially on the art side of the book, where you're seeing a lot of different people come in. And it can be very jarring when an artist comes into a book and has such a different style from what you've known, especially when it's early in the run. If it happens with Spider-Man now, you know, 800 million
right.
issues into it, it's like you can go with like, oh, that's their interpretation of Spider-Man. But when you're establishing the universe and the foundation for these characters, some consistency is, I think, really helpful. And I just feel like with your work, you're super respectful of that while having your own style and adding to what's already there.
Thank you. I don't know a super ton about the history of the industry, but it does seem like the days of like penciling and inking, I feel like there's not as many inkers now as there used to be. So therefore, when an artist is hired to both pencil and ink their own work, and you're still keeping up with a monthly deadline, I think maybe that's what gets these schedules kind of jammed up, because then you just think, okay, I need another artist to give this artist a break. And I think it's easy to set yourself up for burnout if you're really doing a lot.
Yep.
And there's a lot of artists who can do everything, who can pencil, ink, color, and that's a ton of work. So I'm happy inking my own work now. I don't know if I keep taking these books, I might have to hire
yeah.
someone. But anyway, yeah.
That was actually going to be my next question, because I know that you have inked your own work. Is there one part of that process that you prefer over the other, the penciling or the inking?
I love inking.
Yeah.
I just love it so much. So it would be difficult for me to... I mean, I would give it up to someone, because there's a lot of amazing inkers out there
sure.
and I trust them. So it's not... that. It's not that I want control over my work. It's that I just like the process so much.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's me.
So you've got Spider-Woman coming up. I know that you're also working on Pirates of Mars as well, correct?
Yeah, JJ is amazing. He's already turned in all like up to issue 5 of volume 2, and so I'm trying to work in whatever spare time I've got. But what's exciting is that I feel like my work has gotten so much better from when we started. Oh my God, 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. So now when I tackle these issues, I have so much more experience in terms of, you know, fight scenes and establishing shots, and just so I'm happy that my company work is going to help make the self-published work better.
Right, you can carry all that stuff over into that work as well. So for people who aren't here today to get a chance to talk to you but want to keep up with what you have coming up, the Spider-Woman, you know, the Pirates of Mars as well, where's the best place to find you online?
My website is veronicafish.com, and through there you can find me. I think I'm most active on Instagram. I like to blog my sketches and my art. So it's Veronica Fish.
Awesome, and we will put links to both of those in the show notes. I really appreciate you taking time out of a kind of warm day here in Leominster, but your table's been consistently busy today, so I will let you get back to it, and we will talk to you soon.
Well, thanks. Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but Drive-Thru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, Drive-Thru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets Drive-Thru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to drivethroughcomics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.